This is about saying to the dependents, you have suffered the unimaginable, and we've got your back.
A bill to provide health insurance for the families of officers and firefighters who die in the line of duty. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, questions around why the leaking gas line in Cook Inlet hasn't been shut down.
If you can't repair it, you need to shut it down and wait until you can repair things safely.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
The U.S. Attorney for Alaska has submitted her resignation. President Donald Trump on Friday requested the resignation of Karen Loeffler and 45 other U.S. attorneys appointed by President Barack Obama. Loeffler submitted her resignation letter today. Loeffler worked for the U.S. Department of Justice for 29 years, including the last eight as U.S. Attorney for Alaska. She says she first came to the department in January 1988 at the request of former U.S. Attorney Michael Spann to assist in the prosecution of corruption in North Slope Borough contracting. She says in her announcement, "It's been the career of a lifetime to represent her country in court and work with Alaskans to enhance justice and public safety." The State House passed a bill today that would provide health insurance to the families of police officers and firefighters who die in the line of duty. The bill was prompted by the shooting deaths of Trooper Sergeant Patrick Scott Johnson and Trooper Gabe Rich. State law didn't require that their dependents continue to receive health insurance. While Governors Sean Parnell and Bill Walker have ordered that survivors should continue to receive coverage, lawmakers want to make it permanent. Anchorage Representative Chuck Kopp is a retired police officer. He says officers would appreciate it if the bill becomes law.
It's hard to imagine what a spouse and what children go through every day when they see their father or their mom gearing up to go to work. Because the unknown is always there. Will this be the last time?
The House passed a similar bill last year, but the Senate didn't pass it. Supporters are hopeful that its early progress this session will lead to it becoming law. The current bill passed after debate over a series of amendments. Six amendments were defeated. They would have applied the benefits to a wider range of public workers or would have made them voluntary. North Pole Republican Representative Tammy Wilson supported an amendment that would have allowed municipalities to opt out of paying for the benefits.
We're going to make the municipalities come into it, whether or not they want to or not. I think most of them will do it in some form or another. But why are we forcing them to do it?
Bill sponsor Anchorage Democrat Andy Josephson says it's necessary to pay the benefits.
This is about the soul of the state of Alaska. This is about saying to the dependents, you have suffered the unimaginable, and we've got your back.
The Senate State Affairs Committee passed its version of the bill on Friday. It's been referred to the Senate Finance Committee. An ongoing gas leak in Cook Inlet is sparking a debate over pipeline safety. Hillcorp, the responsible company, says it can't shut off the flow of gas through the pipeline without risking an oil spill. But a number of environmental groups disagree. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
It's been over a month since Hillcorp revealed a pipeline fueling offshore oil platforms in Cook Inlet is leaking hundreds of thousands of cubic feet of natural gas per day. A recent letter from the federal agency overseeing the incident revealed the leak began in late December. Dangerous ice conditions in the inlet mean divers may not be able to start repairs for weeks. So environmental groups are intensifying their push to shut down the pipeline. Hilcorp, the biggest oil and gas producer in Cook Inlet, has repeatedly claimed shutting off the gas would be unsafe for workers and the environment. The pipeline carried crude oil until it was converted to gas in 2005. Hilcorp argues shutting off the gas could lead to an oil spill from residual oil in the line. Lois Epstein of the Wilderness Society calls Hilcorp's argument,
frankly, bogus.
Epstein, who has advised the federal government on pipeline safety, says there shouldn't be much oil in the fuel line. She says it would have been flushed out when it was converted to a gas line. Because Epstein doesn't think there's a big oil spill risk, her message to Hilcorp is this.
If you can't repair it, you need to shut it down and wait until you can repair things safely.
Epstein isn't alone. Last week, several national environmental groups, including Greenpeace and the Natural Resources Defense Council, sent a letter to the federal government demanding it force Hilcorp to immediately shut down the pipeline. A local environmental group, Cook Inlet Keeper, is lobbying state legislators to call for a shutdown. But in a March safety order, the Federal Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration gave Hilcorp until May 1st to fix the line or shut it down. The agency agreed with Hilcorp that it would be too risky to shut down the gas line immediately. In the same letter, the federal agency also noted there's a second pipeline nearby, operating in an environment substantially similar to the leaking gas line. That pipeline is carrying crude oil. Epstein argues if the crude oil pipeline was leaking instead, the federal government would be cracking down on Hilcorp.
Hilcorp was, in fact, lucky that it was a gas line because they are having this argument about whether they need to shut down or not. But if it was the oil line or if the breach was closer to the platform, I'm very confident that the state or federal governments would be shutting down this line.
Both Hilcorp and the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration turned down interview requests. The State Department of Environmental Conservation says it's reviewing Hilcorp's environmental monitoring plan and also can't comment until that process is complete. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a dog dies on a plane on the way home from a remote Iditarod checkpoint.
Horrible day. Horrible, horrible, horrible day. I mean, just hearing that news.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Consider Pick-Click-Give to Alaska Rural Veterinary Outreach when filing for your 2017 PFD. This nonprofit provides critically needed veterinary care to rural villages, including spay-neuter surgery, vaccines, basic wellness, and education to help reduce the overpopulation of unwanted pets, high rate of dog bites, and the spread of disease. Learn more at akrvo.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Rural Veterinary Outreach.
Mitch Seavey has a substantial lead in the Iditarod as the top mushers enter the final phase of the race. Seavey reached the Elam checkpoint at 3:26 this afternoon. According to the GPS tracker, Nicholas Petit is racing toward Elam in second, followed on the trail by Dallas Seavey and Yor Olsen. After Elam, the race heads to White Mountain, where mushers take a mandatory 8-hour rest before the final push to the finish line in Nome. The Iditarod Trail Committee says it's changing protocols for how it transports dropped sled dogs after one died Friday while in the organization's care. An early necropsy on the dog showed it had overheated, dying of hyperthermia while on board a plane. Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes spoke to the dog's musher in Keltag.
Scott Smith is lighting a crumpled piece of straw to get a fire going in his cooker. His team is spread out on the ground in the warm sunshine as he talks about Smoke, the young dog that died. Even though Smith had to drop the dog at an early checkpoint in Manly Hot Springs, it was days later, when he arrived in Hooslia, that he was asked to contact race marshal Mark Nordman.
I went into Hooslia the other morning, and I was told, you know, we need to call Mark Nordman, and I spoke with Mark for a few minutes, but there wasn't much in the way of details. I mean, obviously, horrible day. Horrible, horrible, horrible day. I mean, just hearing that news, and I started to get sick on top of that. I was dealing with six dogs, so it was just...
We stopped talking for a second to let an airplane pass overhead.
I mean, I've never lost a dog in any race, you know, and obviously this had nothing to do, you know, with me, but yeah, super low point in my career to ever lose an animal, you know, and Smoke was a nice little dog, man, nice big little dog. He was only a yearling, but I mean, he's a horse. You know, frankly, I put him in this race to give him some experience. I didn't think he'd finish. I just wanted to get him as far as I could and expose him to it. I think it would have helped him mentally. Yeah, I miss him. Obviously, a lot of time to ponder about it, and it's a shame.
Dog deaths during the Iditarod are not uncommon, though it is extremely rare for them to occur while an animal's being looked after off the trail. Smoke was dropped because of a wrist injury. He was moved to Galena and on a plane with 74 other dropped dogs en route to Anchorage, all part of the Iditarod's protocols for getting injured dogs safely off the trail. After discovering Smoke had died from overheating, the trail committee sent out a statement saying they'd been unaware dogs could get hyperthermic in a cool aircraft. To keep it from happening again, they'll no longer transport dropped dogs in coats, and it'll keep airplane cabins chillier and better ventilated. Smith says he doesn't blame anyone for what happened.
It's just one of those things, you know, accidents occur every day, you know, both in the animal kingdom and in, you know, the human world, and I just think, you know, that was probably the case here. And I mean, I don't have a big kennel, you know, I'm really a small kennel and a small outfit, and I like it that way, you know, I like keeping it really personal, so, you know, all my dogs are my family, and it's a really tight-knit group of animals, and, you know, Smoke was pretty new to the fold, but it was no different.
In spite of the tragedy, Smith is glad to be where he is, with his dogs on a warm day by the Yukon River, ready to race with them all the way to the finish. In Caltag, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Iditarod is honoring a late, longtime race volunteer in Caltag with the Herbie Nyakpuk Spirit of the Iditarod Award. Austin Ismelka Sr. helped bring the Iditarod through Caltag for decades. His son-in-law, Iditarod veteran Richard Burnham, accepted the award surrounded by his family in the Caltag Community Hall on Sunday morning.
Austin was always the one that would, when I needed it, would come to me and say, Richard, are we going to go down to Eagle Island, we need to break trail down there and put the trail in for the race is coming. And he would go down without question. And he was involved with it in a lot of ways where he was in the background. And you didn't always see him out in the front, but he was always there as the one that helped to make sure the race happened.
The award is named for the late Shishmaref musher Herbie Nyakpuk and is given to people who have made a major impact on the race. Parts of the interior, like Fairbanks, have been seeing record cold temperatures this winter. But in southeast Alaska, the frigid conditions have had a direct impact on the way people power their homes. As part of the segment Ask the Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins found out how hydroelectricity works or doesn't when the temperature drops.
I haven't seen any icicle beards around town, but Juneau has been noticeably cold. We've had below freezing temperatures for the past week, which is unusual for this time of year. Nancy Waterman says the frigid conditions got her thinking. She's seen water trickling into nearby streams.
So I wonder what the condition is of our hydroelectric reservoirs. Is it all frozen? Is it available to us? Should Juneauites be conserving now, since the weather forecast is for another week?
So I took this question to Alec Mezdag, a director at Juneau's electric utility, Alaska Electric Light and Power. He says when it's cold outside, nothing changes with the hydroelectric dam itself.
What changes this time of year is all the water that in the summertime would fall and flow into a reservoir is now frozen up on the side of a mountain.
Juneau's energy is supplied by four different lakes. Alpine water flows into the lake. And when that water is released through turbines, you get electricity.
You know, that only works if we have water in those lakes stored up in order to do that.
So Mezdag says the cold snap presents a twofold problem. The water in the lakes is low, and you're likely cranking the thermostat at home. At this point, Juneau doesn't have to use its backup power. But that's not the case in other parts of Southeast.
We have, as of this morning, we burned 64,000 gallons of diesel.
That's Mark Adams, Ketchikan Public Utilities Operations Manager. The city of about 8,000 has been running on diesel instead of hydropower since March 6. And it's not the only one. Haines and Skagway have also been supplementing with diesel during the daytime. And Adams says it's the second time this year the city has been forced to make the switch due to the chilly weather.
It's pretty significant. The colder weather will you know, folks are heating their houses, and the wind on the buildings also draws a lot of heat out. So that's a big factor.
Adam says powering with diesel can be expensive. It's caused a noticeable jump in the community's electric bills. Petersburg and Wrangell share the same electric utility, but Ketchikan draws most of its electricity from a different lake.
Wrangell and Petersburg are colder than Ketchikan, but we're significantly larger on our electrical load.
Meanwhile, back in Juneau, Alec Mezdag and I are basking in the glow of lights, still powered by renewable energy.
So it sounds like you can't say with certainty that we won't have to go on diesel this year. It's just really kind of at the mercy of the weather.
Yeah, and that's true of any year.
Mezdag says it looks like Juneau is going to be all right. But should we be waiting for the other shoe to drop? Or in this case, the level of the lake?
Should we be conserving energy when it's really chilly outside?
I think we should always be thinking about conserving energy where we can.
And so I can imagine if I'm listening to this and I hear we should always conserve energy, it could kind of sound like a non-answer a little bit.
So it you know, a lot of it actually kind of comes down to what is your priority with how you use energy. So some people prioritize how much their energy costs. Some people prioritize what the environmental impact of their energy consumption is. And some people are just trying to get by.
And in Southeast, we might be able to get by with heating our homes less. The forecast shows warmer, rainy weather in the weeks to come. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
State House budget writers have restored much of the ferry system cut proposed by the governor for the next fiscal year. The House Finance Committee has added about $2.1 million to the Alaska Marine Highway budget. Governor Bill Walker's spending plan, released in December, included $2.8 million, or 2% less than this year's budget. Marine Highway officials say they did not request the extra money. Spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says if it makes it through the budget process, the system will add a little more than 7 weeks of sailings.
That service would likely be added in May and June of 2018, and that would be to the vessel Fairweather, and it would add 3 port calls per week to Lynn Canal, and then 1 additional run per week between Sitka and Juneau.
The Fairweather is a fast ferry that carries a little more than 200 passengers. It can also hold about 30 cars and trucks. Ketchikan Independent Representative Dan Ortez proposed the increased funding.
Mainly it came out of the numerous comments that I received that talked about real issues that have developed because of the overall reduction in service that the Marine Highway system has had to adapt to due to their reduced funding.
He says one hotel owner told him cuts have cost him $100,000 in business. Others say reduced ferry service makes travel more expensive, including trips for food or medical care. Ortez says marine highway reductions have totaled about 13% over 2 years. He says the rest of the transportation department has had far fewer cuts, and he wants to reduce the difference.
While it certainly doesn't equate to complete equity, it puts the whole equity picture a little bit closer to the parity between coastal Alaska and the money we spend on roads and airports and things like that.
Ortez did not specify how the money should be used. The state ferry Taku is for sale. The minimum price for the 54-year-old ship is $1.5 million. Alaska Marine Highway officials announced the invitation to bid on Saturday. The deadline for proposals is May 9th. The Taku has been tied up at Ketchikan's Ward Cove for more than a year. It's built for long sailings with room for 350 passengers and approximately 50 vehicles. It has 40 staterooms, a cafeteria, observation lounges, and a covered solarium. The Marine Highway had to win federal approval before moving ahead with the sale because federal funds were used for maintenance. It also had to offer the ship to other state and local government agencies, but there were no takers. Officials took the Taku out of service in June of 2015 due to budget cuts, schedule changes, and its age. Scientists who study Arctic climate say their research will suffer if the Trump administration goes ahead with big budget cuts reportedly under consideration for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And they say the proposed cuts would also hinder meteorologists' ability to forecast weather in Alaska and worldwide. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
President Trump has made it clear he has doubts about climate change, and he's declared he'll reduce non-defense-related federal spending. So recent reports about big cuts under consideration for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, have generated a lot of anxiety among scientists who depend on the agency's satellites to study Arctic climate.
We are quite concerned about the possibility of losing an eye in the sky.
Mark Serez is a senior research scientist with the National Snow and Ice Data Center. He says cuts like those reported last week in the Washington Post would cripple NOAA's satellite climate monitoring program that provide information to the Snow and Ice Data Center and many other research agencies.
Certainly, if there were steep budget cuts, then we and many others would really be hurting.
More importantly, Serez says the cuts reportedly under consideration would hamper research essential to meteorologists, especially those who predict weather in Alaska and offshore.
A lot of other people depend on this information. For example, if you want good weather models, good numerical weather prediction, you need to know what the sea ice cover is doing, where that sea ice is.
Zach Labe is a doctoral student with the University of California Irvine's Department of Earth System Science. He studies Arctic sea ice to, among other things, determine whether it influences weather in the middle latitudes.
Budget cuts to the satellite network will not only affect our climate monitoring, but will also affect weather monitoring.
Labe says the satellites are essential for researchers and weather forecasters here and worldwide.
There in Alaska, there are a lot of locations that don't have radar observations, Doppler radar for weather. Meteorologists in Alaska rely on the satellite network to provide weather forecasts.
But Labe and Serez and other researchers who spoke on background for this story all say it's too soon to worry about budget reductions because the administration hasn't completed its proposed budget for the coming fiscal year. The Post story says NOAA's overall budget would be cut by 17% and that the agency's Office of Oceanic and Atmospheric Research by 26%, and that that office's satellite data division would be reduced 22%. An agency spokesman declined Thursday to confirm the numbers or comment on NOAA's budget, and Serez says he thinks Congress wouldn't allow those kinds of cuts.
I strongly feel that what comes out of Congress is going to be quite different than what is proposed.
That's basically how Alaska's senior senator sees it.
Those deep reductions would have a negative impact on not only our nation, but specifically Alaska.
Karina Peterson is a spokeswoman for Senator Lisa Murkowski.
We rely on timely, accurate environmental monitoring and other services from NOAA that help to secure our communities and boost our economy.
Peterson says Murkowski agrees the federal budget needs to be trimmed, but she disagrees with these purported cuts.
Senator Murkowski will absolutely advocate for these programs within NOAA's budget that are key and important to Alaska.
Congressman Don Young spokesman Matt Shukarow says the numbers cited in the Post story and elsewhere are not official. He says once the president sends his proposed budget to Congress, Young will go over it and oppose cuts he believes are harmful to Alaska.
There's been Alaska-specific programs that have fallen under attack in prior years, and the congressman is very good at going to the floor and defending those interests.
The president's expected to send a budget to Congress later in the spring. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
A popular Southeast spring fishing derby won't happen this year because there aren't enough fish. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska has organized the Spring King Salmon Derby for two decades. The Juneau Area Contest has raised close to $500,000 for scholarships to more than 1,500 students. But this year, the State Fish and Game Department announced it was shutting down the king salmon sport fishery in the area. That's because too few fish were expected to return to the Taku River near Derby grounds. Central Council Higher Education Manager Laird Jones said it had no other choice.
So they're closed the fishery from mid-April to mid-June, and the Derby is typically the month of May. So No hooks in the water for king salmon.
He said the council, a regional tribal government, considered moving the Derby dates back, but decided it wouldn't work. Fish and game officials aren't sure why Taku River returns are down. Juneau area management biologist Daniel Teske said the problem is in the ocean, not the rivers where the kings spawn and hatch.
Something's happening out there, whether it be less prey available or more predators, and we are seeing it throughout a bunch of different systems here in Southeast.
The department has also restricted fishing near the Chilkat, Stikeen, and Unik rivers. They're the source of most of the rest of Southeast's king, or Chinook, salmon. Teske said the low runs are part of a trend.
We're in a period of low productivity the last several years, and our projected return for 2017 is well below our escapement goal, and therefore we've had to implement some conservative regulations in order to limit harvest.
The Central Council supports the closure in hopes of building back fish populations. And Jones said Fish and Game provided plenty of notice.
They called our specialists here, oh, I think it was end of December kind of time period, and kind of said, here's what we're thinking. Statisticians were still crunching the numbers, and it was just was looking bad.
The capital city has the second large fishing contest, the Golden North Salmon Derby. It's organized by the group Territorial Sportsmen. Board member Matt Robus said it happens after Taku King's peak.
A very large majority of the fish poundage caught in that August derby is coho. There are a few king salmon and a few other individuals of other salmon species that are caught. But by and large, the whole salmon derby at that time of year is focused and based on the silver salmon run.
Central Council's Jones said his organization is concerned a closure could happen again in 2018.
We're hoping that taking some of these measures might be enough, but if it happens again, we'll have to cross that bridge and see how well our fundraising goes this year.
He said the council still plans to help students with college costs and is considering other methods of raising the money. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld, Andrew Kitchenman, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Elizabeth Harbaugh and Annie Fight in Anchorage, Zachariah Hughes and Ben Matheson in Caltag, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.